Reformed, the Apostle by Grace, by Brother John Mitchell, Chapter 31, A Prayer to Save. Centurions, the backbone of the Roman army, were not just highly paid, experienced soldiers and engineers, but often men of character and discernment. Of those referred to in the New Testament, none is spoken of disparagingly, and two achieved the Lord's highest regard, one for his outstanding faith, and the other as Peter's first Gentile convert. So it comes as no surprise that the man chosen to escort and be responsible for Paul on his voyage to Rome was a considerate man. His name was Julius, and he belonged to the Imperial Regiment. He was also in charge of some other prisoners, and so had a detachment of soldiers to help him. To begin the journey, Julius had selected one of the smaller coastal vessels that plied their trade from port to port along the coast of Asia and Syria. It belonged to Adramyttium and was returning there when it left Caesarea with Paul and his two servants, Aristarchus and Luke, on board. By way of trade, the vessel made Sidon its last port of call before heading for the Aegean. This provided an opportunity for Julius's kindly nature to manifest itself. Whether he thought that Paul was not well equipped for a sea voyage in the autumn of the year, or whether Aristarchus and Luke made representations for him, the upshot was that Julius allowed Paul to go ashore and visit brethren and sisters in Sidon so that they might provide for his needs. From Sidon, the shortest route lay northwest to Lycia, bypassing the south side of Cyprus. But those very same westerly winds that had sped Paul on his way to Jerusalem 2 years before were blowing so hard that the ship had to be steered north of the island and creep along the Cilician coast of Asia instead. By happy coincidence, however, when the vessel reached the port of Myra in Lycia, Julius found in the harbour one of the huge grain ships from Alexandria that were used to convey Egyptian wheat to Italy and keep the restless population of Rome happy with bread and, of course, circuses. The vessel had evidently also had to steer a more northerly course on account of the weather, and Julius was not slow to take the opportunity to transfer his soldiers and his charges to it for the remainder of the voyage. These grain ships were amongst the largest in the Mediterranean, and some idea of the size of this particular vessel is shown by the fact that, in addition to cargo, it had room for 276 passengers and crew when it put to sea again. Nevertheless, although the accommodation was better, the sailing was not. "We made slow headway for many days," reports Luke. And rather than face the full force of the headwinds after Gnidus, the mariners decided to run down southward and sail under the lee of the island of Crete. This they achieved with difficulty, only to be battered again after rounding Cape Metalla, where the coast turned to the north. A little further on, there was a port of sorts called Fair Havens, near the town of Lycia, where they obtained shelter for a while. But because of the persistent delays incurred during the voyage, and the season for sailing in the open seas being past, a decision had to be made whether to make the best of the unsuitable facilities where they were, or to risk reaching a major port at Phoenix further along the coast. In an unusually democratic kind of way, the pilot, the owner of the ship, the centurion, some seamen, and also Paul discussed the issue. The majority were in favour of making a dash for it, but Paul warned them, "Man, I can see that our voyage is going to be disastrous and bring great loss to ship and cargo and to our own lives also." Julius, however, with whom the final decision appears to have rested, not yet knowing Paul's premonitory powers nor his long acquaintance with those treacherous seas, had he not, for example, on a previous occasion been shipwrecked and spent a night and day in the deep? He followed the advice of the pilot and the owner and opted for Phoenix. And at first, when a favourable southerly wind began to blow, Master and crew thought they'd obtained what they wanted. So they weighed anchor and with the lifeboat in tow sailed further along the coast of Crete. It was, however, but the calm before the storm, for not long after a wind of a hurricane force called the Northeaster swept down from the island against which the ship could make no headway. Instead it ran before the storm and was driven 25 miles to the south, where gaining the lee of a small island called Coda, the crew found they were in a desperate situation. As Farrar graphically explained, the ships of the ancients had one main mast and one main sail. Any other masts or rigging were comparatively small and insignificant. Hence, the strain upon the vessel from the leverage of the mast was terrific, and it was impossible that the Alexandrian ship, however slightly built, should have scudded with her huge sail set in the grasp of the typhoon without her timbers startling. It's also evident she'd already sprung a serious leak. The vessel was thus in danger of the most common cause of foundering that sailors feared at that time, and for which the only remedy was to pass hefty ropes under the ship at intervals along its length and make tourniquets of them to hold the timbers together. Having first, with great difficulty, rescued their battered lifeboat and hoisted it aboard, the crew set about undergirding the ship in the prescribed manner, and then fearing they'd run aground on the sandbars of Syrtis on the coast of North Africa, they lowered the sea anchor and let the ship drift whither it would. It took such a battering from the storm right's leak that the next day the crew began to throw the cargo overboard. But still the leakages increased, and so on the third day, to lighten the ship still further, both passengers and crew laboured together to throw overboard the tackling of the ship, including its huge main yard. Then, cold, wet and miserable, and without warm food, they huddled together beneath leaden skies, from which both sun and stars, the mariner's only guide, were absent for many days. So, as the storm raged unabated, the whole company lapsed into despair. All, that is, except Paul, who'd been praying to the only God who could save them, and whose son had assured him he must reach Rome and bear witness to him there. Gathering both crew and passengers together, Paul first lectured them and then told them the good news. Then, he said, you should have taken my advice not to sail from Crete. Then you would have spared yourselves this damage and loss. But now I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost, only the ship will be destroyed. Last night an angel of the God whose I am and whom I serve stood beside me and said, do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar. God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. So keep up your courage, men, for I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me. Nevertheless, we must run aground on some island. From which it is evident that Paul had been praying for the safety not only of himself, but of every other soul that was in the vessel with him.